Chapter 10. Erda. I found myself upon a great throne that pulsed with an energy that terrified, that rattled through my core and made the colors of the world shift with each surge. All around me were the clouds, spinning above and below in the never-ending maelstrom. Beyond the clouds was the vast length of Erda, the green hills and rocky cliffs, the pebbled sandy beaches, the forests, the rivers and the lakes, the kingdoms, the cities, the oceans, the creatures that walked and crawled and scurried and flew and swam. I looked up and saw them. I looked down and saw them. To the left and to the right, I saw the world all around me. I turned to look backward and saw Erda stretching away, far, far away beyond the lands of Olaf the Wise, where the opposing barrier mountains ringing the land all around in a forever circle, climbing so high that the tops nearly scraped each other at the center. I turned back and examined the throne that held me. It was golden and burned brighter than the hottest forge I'd ever seen, and beneath my dangling feet, I could see the lower heartstrings stretching all the way to the ocean below. I knew if I looked up, I would see the matching heartstring, but I did not look up out of fear. I was certain I'd become dizzy again and slip from the throne to fall to my death. I was so very high up. I imagined I would fall for hours before hitting the water. Looking ahead through Dithmar's kingdom and beyond, further than my eyes should have allowed, I saw the other side, the other barrier mountain, the small hole in the center that was level with my eyes, and then, perhaps a third of the way down to the floor below, my own body on the mountainside. My body was half a world away from me and should have been impossible to see at that distance. But there it was, laying on the rocks, eyes closed and mouth hanging. I realized suddenly that Sunna's throne was gone, and then right after that realized I knew I'd been sitting upon Sunna's throne. I probably should have been terrified at the thought of his retribution for my insolence, but all I could think of at the time was that I was not falling in any direction. I should have been screaming with fear, but I only hung there out in the open, floating, weightless. The throne was gone now, and the heartstrings with it, and there was only me, suspended in the firmament. I looked all about and discovered the clouds were no longer moving, not around me anyway. Closer down to the ground, they moved, pulled along in a spiral, spiraling out from the center where I floated. I was the center of the clouds, the center of everything, and the clouds were being pulled in a spiral by the ground. And then I realized in a kind of spiritual crisis that the ground was moving, that it was spinning. All of Erda was spinning around me. The Verm itself flew through the outer chaos in a continuous, eternal spiral, and all of the creatures that crawled along the surface of the ground did not fall over for some reason. They just walked along, pursuing the business of their lives, never knowing that the ground turned beneath their feet. And somehow, through the love of the gods, they did not fall over and go tumbling up the sides of the belly. I sensed a great well of power at the center of my body, radiating outward like the rainbow colors of Ing's own skin radiated over her body as she moved, and understood that this power fueled all of Erda, that it would pour forth from me for all time like a gout of blood, and that the land would drink it up greedily, always sucking for more. And more I would give, inexhaustible. And I knew that beyond Erda there were more worlds, worlds just as vast as my own, worlds with their own peoples, and their own gods, and their own thrones of power. Worlds connected to worlds, connected to worlds. Birth, life, death, war, famine, folly, prosperity, struggle, disease, love, sex, loss, desire, hate, corruption, absolution, over and over and over. I screamed. I was back on the mountain again. The wind came at me, carrying a stinging wetness into my cheeks and eyes. I tried to enfold myself in my own arms, but the relief this brought was minimal. Sometimes you just got cold within, from the bones outward, and when you did, There was no help for it at all. You either got used to misery, or ultimately misery got used to you. Ing was still there as well. She sat before me on the gritty rock, legs crossed and looking quite comfortable despite the chill. I was sprawled on my back, but she still held my hand in hers. It was in her lap, and she turned it over and over, as if she was studying something. When I stirred, she let it go. I felt better when I sat up. I don't know why. Whereas before, something within my mind felt disconnected and flapping around as if loose. Things were now locked into place, battened down. All within my body took on a kind of precision, as if everything knew what it was supposed to be. It felt as though what made me had decided to quit fighting against itself. It was more profound than that, really, but I don't have the words to describe it. Something was definitely different. I'd been sleepwalking through my entire life, and was now suddenly awake. I was chosen. When I saw the tears running down her cheeks, I became very worried. I asked, "Oh, great mother of the world, why are you crying?" She dipped her head and said, "I have seen your life." I looked away. Her words shamed me. "You've seen the things I've done?"
"I've seen what has been done."
She took my face in her hands. They were very hot, I remember that much. They closed over my cheeks, and I thought about pulling away because I didn't want the filth of my skin on her beautiful hands. I couldn't stand for her to be so profaned. But that warmth hit me like an open flame. It healed me of the cold so that I no longer shivered. They were hot, terribly hot, and I felt great pain. But after the pain, there was another feeling I couldn't understand. It was the same way I felt when I knew there was enough money to carry me through the week, or when I had a full belly, or when I woke up in the morning in the place I expected to be. It was a merry fire. It was Ambrosius's head resting on my thigh. At the time, I tried to think of a name for that feeling, but could not. She pulled me close, and her lips touched against my forehead. I began to cry silently. I was angry, very angry. All of it was shameful. My life had been a shameful act. My very birth had been a shame on my mother, whoever she had been. I shamed the air by breathing it, and now I shamed myself through my own tears, crying like that. It was pitiful. Women did that. Children did that. Men were supposed to be so much more. But then I've never been very good at being what I should. But she held on to me like that, locked my whole body in place with those two soft, hot, beautiful hands. She kissed me a second time on the forehead again. And then she whispered,
"You are my son now, Udo."
Then I was laying there again, trying to figure out what had happened. Ing was gone. She was gone. And my heart was broken. Only, she wasn't. Laying there on the hard rock, freezing my balls off and wondering how in hell's great name I was going to find my way to the bottom, her voice came to me. It came from inside me, surged through me. Her voice became me. It doesn't make any sense at all. I suppose you would have to speak with a god to understand. Eyes opened wide, staring up at the other side of the mountain range hanging down from the cavern like a vast curtain. I heard her.
"Your brother lies beneath you toward the foot of the mountain, Udo. Find him. Care for him. Keep him safe."
There was only the wind after the words faded away. I tried to say something, maybe croak out a yes, but the words would not come. It didn't matter. I knew she heard me even if I could say nothing at all. I rose to my feet and surveyed the slope and the floor far below. There were gentle foothills down at the bottom, covered at first with grass, but then the grass thinned out and died as the ground got higher. Pretty soon it was just a bunch of rock, which also perfectly describes the little outcrop upon which I stood. Beyond the grass was the forest. Looking to my right, westward, I saw that the Ruhr was still where I'd left it.
The downward slope looked terribly steep from my position. I don't know what it is about a mountain, but you never realize how steep the son of a bitch is until you get to the top of it. You stand on the ground looking up at the bastard and think, sure, that's a gentle climb, I could make that without even trying. Up at the top, it's like staring down into hell's own mouth. I was ringed in by a circle of boulders that wrapped the edge of the outcrop like a railing. It was a perfect little area, if you could ignore the cold. It was as if someone had built that spot for me to stand on so that I could look out into the world and survey my domain. Standing at the edge and looking over, I thought I saw a narrow trail snaking back and forth along the mountainside, switching and switching back again. The longer I looked at it, the more I could see it. At first, it was like a suggestion in the rock. Then maybe a trail a goat could follow. After tracing it with my eyes a few times and confirming that it seemed always to head down to the ground, the trail stood out to me so clearly I wondered how I ever missed it. It wasn't even a trail, in fact. I was looking at a damned path. You want to be careful when traveling close to the mountaintops. You don't feel the same up there. You're not as heavy. You can feel it in your step, as if the ground is about to let you go every minute. I had never in my life been as high as I was on that day, and the feeling had never been so strong. I couldn't will myself to take a step without holding on to the boulders surrounding me. I had to be sure I could stop myself if I began to float away. At first, I thought it was just a feeling, like maybe my mind was playing tricks on me. But at the first part of the trail, I tried to hop off a small boulder to the path beyond, and it took me far too long to land. I was sure I was going insane. But when I scrambled back onto the boulder and tried again, I was able to count off nearly 3 seconds before my feet made contact, and I didn't have to bend my knees that much to absorb the impact. After that, I was pretty violently sick. I took my sweet time along the rest of that path. I'm not sure how long it was before I started feeling my normal weight again. I know it went sundark as I climbed, which only made the task more interesting, and then the rest of the journey was achieved by the pale light on Zintgund. I counted my blessings that she was so vibrant that night, that I could still see the path ahead so clearly. I wondered if Ing had spoken to her on my behalf, and then berated myself for the presumption. As I neared the bottom, the path took me around a narrow boulder that stood 3 times taller than a draft horse. On the other side, I saw a clearing far enough away that it appeared almost to be on the top of the grass field, but I think the perspective must have been playing tricks on my eyes. There was a man lying in the middle of the clearing, splayed out on his back. He appeared to be naked, and there were 4 or 5 shadowed children moving quickly around him, kind of hunched over, and their hands reached out sometimes and touched his body. I called out to them and waved my hands over my head. They all froze, and I thought I could see them looking up at me, but they were so dark it was impossible to be sure. I called out again in case they couldn't see me, and they all scrambled toward the base of the mountain. They seemed to run off at different angles, and when they met the rocks, they disappeared. Only the man remained. I wondered if he was dead.